Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. Lots to talk about this hour. Joining us in studio, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Joe, welcome as always.
It's great to be here.
And Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Kathy,
good morning.
Welcome back. And Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Laura, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
A lot happening in Washington today, so we asked Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Dispatch, to join us as well by phone. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Man, I didn't know I was talking to such a distinguished panel, so I'm very excited to be here.
Yes, it is. It is a panel. You know, it's one of my favorites.
All girls.
No, all. Well, of course, it's an all girl, like an all girl band, right? Very powerful. Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman, has been indicted on federal charges. What do we know? What's going on?
So these are what are believed to be possibly the first of who knows how many charges in this investigation into whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And these charges themselves are not really necessarily – Trump can make the case that this doesn't really have anything to do with his actual campaign. Because mm-hmm. what's happening here was that Paul Manafort, who was actually Trump's campaign manager later, and Richard Gates, who was also a campaign – so for years they served as political consultants and lobbyists for the government of Ukraine, the Party of Regions, and this fellow named Viktor I'm probably slaughtering this name.
Yushchenko?
Yanukovych.
Okay.
My Russian
we'll just call him Vic.
Pronunciation yeah. is not so great. So anyway, this happened between 2016 and 2015. And apparently they never reported, they are accused of never reporting their income from this, hiding their income overseas so that they didn't have to pay taxes and basically laundering the money. Now, Trump could basically say this doesn't have anything to do with the campaign itself. Mm-hmm. However, you know, again, this might be just the beginning. I mean, this might be the way of for Robert Mueller to kind of look at, you know, to kind of start closing the circle, you know, to sort of getting these kind of outside guys and then kind of moving into the more of the inner circle. Not sure yet. We're going to mm-hmm. have to kind of wait to see how this goes. But they are the first charges. They are. It looks from this indictment basically like Manafort and Gates just really, really were living high off the hog from this unreported lobbying. And, I mean, it looks like a pretty lavish lifestyle that they created for themselves by working with this Russian-affiliated political party in Ukraine.
So, Laura Bischoff, what does this look like to you?
Well, it seems that that they're not done, that the Mueller investigation is there's always a chance that there could be more charges. Oftentimes in white-collar investigations, they'll start with a smaller player or a player of some level anyway, and then leverage the charges against those players to try to get up, kind of move up the food chain. And we'll see if that's what happens or not. I mean, it could be the end. I mean, maybe this is the only thing that comes out of this investigation, but it could also just be the start of it.
Yeah.
I think you'll also see the Trump administration move pretty quickly to distance themselves mm-hmm. from these two, Manafort. And I think there was another, wasn't there a second indictment, Gates?
Yes.
Yeah, his
yes.
Sidekick, Robert.
Robert Gates.
Both of them worked on the Trump campaign.
Richard.
So.
Richard Gates.
Gates.
Sorry, it's not
Richard.
Robert Gates.
Wrong Gates.
Sorry,
gosh. It's not Gates, Bill, sir. Not Robert, but Richard Gates. Okay.
We've already seen Trump.
Going, wait, what?
Well, we've already seen Trump, though, and himself trying to, make this investigation seem as if it's a witch hunt, a political witch hunt.
Right.
And, you know, he's trying to belittle the actual investigation itself. So you have to wonder, you know, why he's just all this, you know, just really going after it in that way.
It seems like, I mean, whether or not it's because there's some kind of criminal activity involved in his own campaign activities or whether or not he just feels it undermines the legitimacy of his election is could be what it's all about. You just don't know yet.
Yeah,
he's going to do that. He's going to keep talking about the fake news. But, you know, when there's indictments, it gets a little bit harder to make the fake news
right.
case. And he's going to continue to say that it's politically motivated, which, you know, is an argument that he can make. But you have to remember that it wasn't really Mueller who decided to do this indictment. It was an independent grand jury. He, He persuaded a federal judge to set up a grand jury, but he presented the evidence that his team found, and it was the independent grand jury that decided to actually return the indictment. So let's just remember that.
I'm kind
of decided not to.
I'm a little frantically whipping through Twitter right now. I had not checked to see if the president tweeted anything yet today.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? I haven't either. I was actually so busy reading the indictment that I wasn't doing the thing I normally do the first thing on a Monday morning, which is go, okay, it's going to happen.
as things unfold, we shall see. But if anyone hears what the president said about this, I'm all ears.
I'm looking it up now. I'm in front of my laptop, so I'll let you know. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
So please hold while I do that.
Well, I'll just tell everybody that you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. By phone, we have Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Jessica Wehrman. We're talking about the indictments that have been handed down from a federal grand jury for Paul Manafort. I'm sorry.
No tweets.
No tweets. Okay, no tweets yet. Silence is... deafened by the
story
silence.
In itself,
yeah,
right
exactly.
There, yeah.
Exactly. Paul Manafort, former campaign...
Chairman
for the Trump presidential campaign, and also his protege, Rick Gates. Have been indicted. They were surrendered today, this morning already. Laura Bischoff?
Now, I would say that an indictment is an accusation that has to be proven in court.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beginning of the process. But they're facing 12 counts, conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, unregistered agents of a foreign principal, false and misleading U.S. Foreign Agents Registration Act statements, 7 counts of failure to file reports of foreign bank and financial accounts. This sounds pretty serious. And usually when you... I would say the one that sounds the most serious is conspiracy against the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That probably, if convicted of that, carries a lot of years
mm-hmm.
in prison.
We'll see how that unfolds as the day unfolds. But first, Jessica, before I let you go, I wanted to talk about the story you had on the front page of the Dispatch today about...
T. Berry.
Congressman T. Berry, the headlines, future job tax rewrite role raise concerns. What's going on?
T. Berry last week, Congressman Pat T. Berry last week, after many years in Congress, decided that he was going to step down to accept a job with the Ohio Business Roundtable, which is an organization that's created of the heads of a lot of the powerful Ohio companies. GE is on there. Honda is on there. I mean, you kind of name it's like sort of a who's who of the business community chairman. And he decided to step down from Congress basically at the end of next January in order to accept this job. Somebody had raised the point to me that this is kind of unusual because the reason he's waiting until the end of January is so he can write tax reform. Now, if there's anyone who has a stake in tax reform, corporate tax reform, it would be many of the companies that he will be, I guess, working for now. So they kind of question the ethics of this and question sort of is this an inherent conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, none of them say he's actually broken any ethics rules because you are required to self-recuse when you are a member of Congress and you feel like there's a conflict of interest. I've been here, I'm going to make myself look really old here, but
no,
I've been here
couldn't.
Probably about 20 years. I can't actually recall anyone really recusing themselves on these sort of things. Ethics lawyers that I talked to said, the rules say you should do this if it looks like there's a conflict of interest, but you could also make the argument that it's got to be a very specific conflict of interest. For example, if the Ohio Business Roundtable wanted a very specific earmark or something like that. This is sort of a more global issue. T. Berry's people also argue everyone pays taxes, but the watchdogs I talked to said, you know what, everyone doesn't pay the corporate tax,
mm-hmm.
and these guys do have a very vested interest in how this turns out.
What are the ethics people saying?
I mean, the ethics people think that it doesn't look great. Now, I was also kind of remembering when John Boehner stepped down, when Dave Hobson stepped down, they took what they call a year off to basically they call it a blackout year where you don't lobby.
Yeah.
Now, T. Berry is off the hook in terms of as long as he doesn't actually interact with members of Congress directly, he's fine. But again, there's this conflict, and really most of the conflict that is presented here is that he's staying and doing tax reform, and not just doing tax reform. He's a key member of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's a senior member. He's got some juice on this issue.
And by the way, the job that he's going to be taking with the roundtable is highly paid, at least his predecessor, Richard Stauff. He had a base compensation of about $254,000, and then there was...
It was in the 700s by the time everything was...
Exactly. Other reportable compensation, which we don't really know what that is, but it racks it up to $692,038.
Yeah, and members of Congress make $149,000, I believe.
Right.
So it's a raise. He's getting a raise.
It's a big raise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bigger raise than I've ever gotten.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big
one. Should have replied.
So there's a lot at stake.
Yeah. Yeah, it's they just say it. Sometimes it's, things just don't look good. And this isn't, it just isn't great optics.
Joe Ingles?
I don't know. I think, honestly, you're right. It doesn't look good, but if you think about it, how many things in Congress does look good these days? I'm sorry to raise
that.
Well,
you've got a point.
Well, it's not going to really change the position you would have expected T. Barry to take 6 months ago on tax reform.
Right.
That he would,
The devil, as another, would be in the details.
Doesn't make it
so
right.
It does attract scrutiny, does it not, Jessica?
It does. The timing of it is what sort of kind of, and I also guess this means he thinks that they're actually going to get tax reform done. So maybe this sort of means... This is optimistic that they'll actually get it done by the end of January. Typically, the bills that are this big take a little bit longer, but, the folks I talk to are convinced that this can happen by the end of January, meaning he will have a key say in what we do about the corporate tax.
I used to think it did take longer to get bills of this magnitude through, but it seems like this past year, the things they tried to whip through Congress has been shocking.
The
magnitude
detail,
of which, and the speed with which.
That these are this is a new time.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
No, they've tried to whip them through.
Yeah,
they tried to.
They've tried. That's a key word.
Yeah, they haven't really done much anything.
And I think that think about this. If there is a huge scandal this fall, if this Manafort thing kind of takes over and goes huge, you could get a lot of people who are more. A lot of these politicians who are looking more at the political optics of the things that they do and, try to distance themselves maybe from the Trump administration if they think there's some blowback or something. You just never know. I mean, I've learned with this administration, don't count anything out.
Right.
Well, Republicans are under enormous pressure right now to get something done on tax reform. They haven't had any major legislative accomplishments. Mm-hmm. And I think heading into, an election year, they're going to want, so there may be a lot more political will with tax reform than what we've seen with some of the other issues like health care.
There really is pressure to get something, anything done, just so they can, how do you go into a campaign and say, we were going to do this and this, but
how do you govern that way where you're driven by what you can put on your campaign flyer? I mean, not that that's a novel-like concept. I know that happens all the time, but...
That's exactly how we govern.
But this is particularly embarrassing to the Trump administration and to Congress because the Republicans control all three branches of government, and so they should be able to get their agenda done. But there's been so much infighting and drama,
and the party itself is so fractured.
Right. It's really big wedges. The Freedom Caucus and the Business Republicans and the Trump people and. Right. It is. You're right. It's fractured.
And Jessica, just before I let you go, is there any sense about that there's more indictments coming down this week or any kind of feel for that?
I don't have a real sense on what's coming next on this. I imagine sort of as this shakes out, we'll get, we'll start to hear whispers of what comes next. But I think right now everyone's sort of still kind of processing this indictment and what this means and what it means for the investigation as well.
Okay. Jessica Wehrman, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye, Jessica.
Jessica Wehrman, she's Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we will continue our conversation. There's a lot to talk about. Open enrollment deadline looms. We're going to talk about state Supreme Court Justice Bill O'Neill's entry into the Democratic primary. We're going to talk about Cliff Hight, the state lawmaker who has now left his office amid an investigation and accusations of sexual harassment. And also issue two, what's up with that? We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. 2018 election for Ohio governor is heating up in the Democratic side. The four Democratic candidates, at least the four that were candidates on Sunday, met yesterday for two debates. And State Supreme Court Justice William O'Neill announced he's entering the race. That now makes five. There's a couple things going on here. I was confused. The Democrats knew, the Democratic Party knew on Friday that he was going to enter the race, but they said they weren't able to do proper vetting for him to be able to participate in the debate. What do you mean proper vetting? He's a sitting Supreme Court justice.
He's run before on a statewide ballot. You think they would have already vetted him?
Yeah,
I don't understand.
That seemed kind of lame to me.
Well, maybe what they meant, and I'm not going to assume anything, but maybe what they meant is usually these debates, you know, you have to go through each individual candidate and get their camp to agree to all the details of it and how it's going to be done. And so if you throw someone new in there, you might be dealing with, I don't know how many people they're dealing with, but you might be dealing with a lot of moving parts.
Okay.
So Justice O'Neill,
I'm going to say that. Just okay. Give him the benefit of the doubt here. Okay.
Laura?
Justice O'Neill is one of only two statewide Democrats to hold office in Ohio.
And the other his being is the only Sherrod elective Brown. Office.
No, Sherrod Brown.
Oh, Sherrod Brown. Well, yeah, that's right.
So you got
right.
Sherrod Brown and Bill O'Neill. They're the only statewide elected Democrats.
Right.
You're right. You know, he's the sitting justice. Like, you'd think he'd already been vetted. But I think that the Democratic Party is a little gun-shy, given that they really blew it with
Ed Fitzgerald,
that the vetting, that their candidate for governor in 2014 did not have a driver's license for.
Well, they didn't vet him, though. That was part of the.
Yeah, they didn't.
It sounded like to me like they never vetted him at all.
Right. So maybe now they're trying to make sure that they ask some basic questions like, do you have a driver's license?
Yeah.
Have you paid your taxes? You know,
where were you at 4 a.m. in that parking lot?
Yeah.
I think that the
O'Neill's
race is
a little bit of a character, so there might be some questions they want to ask him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he used to work as an emergency room nurse,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
Right.
He's obviously a lawyer, former emergency room nurse. He's a U.S. Army vet. Lots to talk about. And the issues that he's raised, $15 an hour minimum wage, legalized recreational marijuana, and high-speed rail. He seems to be tapping into a lot of the things that I thought the Democrats have been gun-shy over for many years now, and maybe to their, you know, I've always thought that doing things like high-speed rail and maybe legalization would ignite some excitement in the party, particularly among the younger voters.
Right.
So I think O'Neill getting in the race doesn't really help the Democrats in that now they'll have five candidates who aren't really well known. And they're all still waiting to find out, is Rich Cordray going to get in the race or not get in the
race?
And
he says, Bill O'Neill says he will immediately exit.
I question he'd exit if Cordray got into the race. I question, how serious of a candidate are you if you're a candidate if this or if not that?
What's he trying to say with that? That he doesn't think any of the other candidates are good enough?
I think he thinks that the other candidates don't have enough name recognition, that people are not familiar enough with them, and that he has, you know, he's been on a statewide ballot and won, that kind of thing. So, and the others have not been on a statewide ballot.
He's not satisfied with the other candidates. It may not be personal, like you're saying. It may just be name recognition and such.
Richard Cordray, his job, all things being equal, is expected to end sometime in June when his term runs out. And President Trump is not expected to reappoint him, but he can't wait until June to announce for
the
primary.
No, the primary is in May.
Exactly. So
he can't by law, he is not allowed to discuss politics.
Right.
He's got to either get in or, say, I'm not getting in, or it's either happening
or not
happening.
Seems like the time is now, doesn't
it? Yeah, you need about 6 months to prepare for a statewide primary.
If you want to be a serious candidate, sure you do.
Yeah, I believe so, too.
Raise money. I don't know how much money he may or may not have on hand.
I think he's very well connected to the Obama folks and Elizabeth Warren, and I think he could get some national help to raise. That's one of his big advantages is that he's seen as somebody who could raise a lot of money pretty quickly.
Yeah.
At the same time, he's been on the statewide ballot 5 times, and he's won 2 of those races. Mm-hmm. But he's been out of the Ohio political scene for the better part of 6 years now. So, I think he'd have to reintroduce himself to voters.
I also think the longer he waits, the more of a spoiler he becomes for the other candidate. The other candidates are doing debates. They're doing what they should be doing early in the early stages of a race like this. Mm-hmm. And for him to kind of, just jump in late in the game, kind of bigfoot those that have been kind of, working their butts off. Meanwhile, I think, I don't think that would work out well for him either. I think that would be negative. The other thing I want to mention is O'Neill has said he'll step down from the court to campaign.
Right.
Which is a real problem for the Democrats, because the Republican governor would get to appoint his replacement. So they're basically giving up their seat on the Supreme Court, the lone Democratic seat on the Supreme Court, for him to jump into a 5-person
race. Then they have to find somebody else to replace him in an election.
So that's like a 50% reduction in statewide elected Democrats.
I just kind of wonder.
That's easy math I can do, too. Yeah.
I just kind of wonder, though, if this isn't kind of his way of saying, someone get in this race other than me, He's saying that. He's saying,
But who else?
Well,
Jerry Springer.
There is Jerry Springer, I guess, yeah. We kind of chuckle with Jerry Springer because of his background,
Jerry Springer is a very intelligent man.
But he is a very intelligent man. When you when you talk to him, you realize that. There's much more than that TV show.
But you can't get beyond the, writing a check for a prostitute and some of the stuff associated with this TV show. I mean, he carries a lot of negatives.
Hey, wait. We have a president in the White House that got beyond an Access Hollywood take.
Maybe it works in his favor yeah. now. I don't know.
He won in Ohio by 8 percentage points. So, Laura, you're just very quiet.
I think I was talking to some very liberal friends of mine, and we were talking about Jerry Springer, and I said, the guy's really, he's very smart, and he's very well versed on lots of different issues. And they're like, there's no way I would ever vote for that man because he basically introduced America to horrible reality TV and made tons of money exposing the worst side of America. And I thought, well, if he can't win with this super liberal voter that I know, then
would that be his base though? I'm thinking that's probably not his base. I think he would be going for the person who voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, he would go right up the middle and try to grab those people who maybe are disaffected. I don't know what we want to call that group. But
I did get to hang out with Jerry Springer at the Democratic National Convention for a day, and it was a hoot. And he is he's very quick-witted, very smart, and everybody wanted their picture taken with him. All the cops, all the wait staff, the security people,
very
the drivers.
Than what you see on TV.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I just had coffee with him one time back when I worked for the Toledo Blade. And, I think it was probably the last time he was sort of bandied about as a potential candidate. And, I didn't know anything about him, really, except that he had been mayor
of Cincinnati.
Yeah. But some people, I get what you're saying, Laura, they think anyone who had that much ability, that much intelligence, and then devotes his life to reality TV, the likes of the Jerry Springer show, they question his, what's he really committed to?
Right.
So, all right. Speaking of questioning what you're really committed to, Cliff Height, state lawmaker, is resigned from his office very, very suddenly. And the details emerged last week about why. Laura Bischoff, what's going on?
So, yeah, Cliff Height was a Republican from Findlay. He's a former high school teacher and football coach. He's known as a gregarious guy.
Very friendly and well-liked.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Known as a hugger.
Mm-hmm.
And he was accused by somebody who works for the Legislative Service Commission. That's a bipartisan a nonpartisan
right.
Arm of state government that like writes the bills and does the analysis.
They do all
things.
The dirty work, people.
Yeah, they do.
They're
the heavy lifters.
Yeah.
Anyway, it started out where he introduced himself to this woman and commented on her outfit. Then he asked her to friend him on Facebook. And then it accelerated from there, in which he propositioned her for sex. He said, "I'm a grown man with needs." He described his marital sex life to this woman, and he used very crude terms and the terms are included in a memo that was released late Friday. The LSC. Legislative Service Commission, when they found this woman complained, and then they assigned an attorney to investigate her allegations, and then they wrote a memo, a report of it.
What she alleges is such a classic case of harassment. It's almost textbook.
Right. Yeah. And I do think that harassment and assault is, you know, it's more about power and control.
Right.
Right.
And there's a lot of power and control in politics. And, and what's interesting is that no one really stepped up to defend him after years of service. You know, there wasn't the big goodbye,
"We're
thank you
wait
for your service."
Until he's been right. It's been adjudicated or whatever.
They accepted his resignation and they packed up his stuff and mailed it over to or shipped it
and
to
you
him.
Get the feeling that there are some discussions behind the scenes before he announced about maybe what he should do.
Mm-hmm.
You just get the impression that leadership was kind of involved in some discussions about it before. You know,
yeah, they weren't. Didn't seem to be taken off guard.
Seemed to all have been kind of planned out.
I think it dovetailed into the campaign of Me Too and the Harvey Weinstein mm-hmm. story, and you know a lot of the other things that are coming out. And I think that probably at this time in history, the Republican leadership in the Senate recognized that they could not take this lightly.
He has been around a while. He served in the House as well, right? He's one of those that have right. gone back and mm-hmm. forth.
Yes. And, you know, I think that there's, like, right now, there's in overall, nationwide, there is a realization that sexual assault and sexual harassment, that these things are far more common than anyone ever thought, and that most women have had on some level, they have had situations where they have felt intimidated, pressured. They've somehow been, you know, at the receiving end of a man who behaves very badly to try to get what he wants. And I think there's a certain amount right now among the public, there's a certain amount of sentiment that they're not going to put up with it anymore. They're not going to, you know, say, "Oh, well, your skirt was too short," or "You were asking for it because mm-hmm. you did this or that." It seems like right now I'm seeing, at least when I read about these things, I'm seeing a lot of people say, "Wow, you know, is this, you know, for real? It happens this often?" And it seems like there's a little bit of a turning tide there. Mm. I don't know. I don't know.
Especially egregious when you have a subordinate, you know, relationship involved. I mean, this woman did not directly work for Cliff Height, but she worked for an agency that serves the legislators by providing analysis for their bills. So,
right.
So she would have felt that kind of a pressure as if she had worked, you know, directly for him.
Yeah, one of the accusations was that he apparently followed her around the Statehouse parking garage
yeah.
in his car. I go through that parking garage every day. I think we all do. Anyone who can, you know, put that in their mind, it's like, wow, that would be a very uncomfortable position.
Yeah. And the only way to get away from it was to actually go back into the Statehouse.
And what she described was months of him propositioning her.
Badgering her.
And her turning him down weeks and weeks and mm-hmm. weeks. and him not relenting. This isn't just one, according to her, this is not just one incident of him propositioning her.
Right.
This is weeks and weeks, months of him trying to get her.
And once again, he put it in writing. Mm-hmm. He wrote her Facebook messages or something.
Text messages. Yeah. And with all the cameras around the state house. Seriously, I'm sure there's video too.
It makes you wonder if there's going to be more stuff coming out, not about him necessarily, but just in general at the state house.
You know, it's I'm not sure if it was the I think it was the New York Times reported on sexual harassment culture in legislative capitals. There's a big problem in California, and then they outlined, I think, maybe five or six other states.
I saw that, too. I can't remember.
I'm pretty sure it was the New York Times. And so it makes you wonder, if there is this culture, if it is happening, are women, are they, do they not want to report it because they don't think it's going to be taken seriously? That's the problem in California, according to this story, is that you'd have to report it to the rules committee of such and such. And who's on the rules committee?
State lawmakers.
Right.
But let's not forget, I mean, it's also happening in the media. I mean, Mark Halperin, I mean, that's coming out right now. We're seeing more and more.
He's been dismissed by NBC, right?
Right. In news and also in the entertainment side of it, in Hollywood, we're seeing it. I don't think that there is really any part that of this segment of society that's safe right now, because it
for
looks,
the predators for
right
the harassers.
For safe for predators,
yeah.
Because right now you know, women feel more emboldened to talk about these experiences, and the more people come out with this Me Too campaign, the more people come out and talk about it, I think we're going to see a lot of things that we didn't see before publicly.
We will continue our weekly reporters roundtable. Still lots more to talk about. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. We still have lots to talk about. Before we move on to some more politics, I did want to talk about the deadline for open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act. Kathy Kandiski, it's a much shorter window of opportunity now.
Correct.
There's not going to be any advertising, really, of note, because there's no money. The Trump administration's put the kibosh on the money,
correct,
and they've shrunken the window.
That's right. Open enrollment period starts November 1st. This is when folks who don't get their insurance through like their employer or through one of the government programs like Medicare or Medicaid can sign up for enrollment on what are called marketplace exchanges. And Ohio has one, and different insurers provide plans that people can shop for and purchase. The enrollment period last year was about, I think it was like November 1st through the end of January. This year it's been cut in half. It's going to run through December 15th. So advocates are worried that people aren't going to know, people are going to wait, they're going to miss out on their chance. The other thing that's important is, well, as you mentioned, the Trump administration cut advertising, cut funding to navigators, which are people that provide
95%
help
of the funding, yeah, or
correct,
90%, yeah.
I think cut about 70% of the funding to navigators,
yeah,
which are folks that give like kind of in-person help, because this, you know, is confusing to kind of evaluate these plans and figure out what's the best for you. The other thing people are going to notice is the expense. The plans are costing more. Now, the good news is about 75% of the people that purchase these plans qualify for subsidies. So the subsidy is going to take care of the increase for you. But if you're somebody who's a little higher income and does not qualify for a subsidy, you're going to see about a 30% increase in the cost this year, which is significant, obviously.
Right. The registration period, the open enrollment period is pretty much, I think, almost cut in half, right?
Correct. Start
yeah,
November
90
1st,
days
starts
to 45
Wednesday
days. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there are a few places that are still offering help. We talked to Columbus City Health Department. Is going to have counselors 2 days a week. You can walk in and get help there. There's some other groups that are helping people sign up.
UCAN Ohio? Are they still
I'm not sure about them.
Sure they
I
are.
Know that Lisa Hamler Fugit with the Second Harvest Food Banks,
yeah.
they have been instrumental in the last few years being the navigators and going in and helping their population sign up. And she is distressed about not being able to do that this year. They couldn't, the funding being pulled, they just couldn't do it.
It's complicated. And, I mean, you
right.
have to figure, you have to have people
right.
that are, that's what they're doing.
Well, they
right.
helped thousands of people sign up for insurance. So, of course, her concern is where are those thousands of people
right.
going to go for help this year?
Yes.
Right. It's a legitimate question.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is that there's also this, they think it will be more difficult because the website apparently is going to be shut down part of that time.
Shut down for maintenance every
right.
Sunday.
Yeah. I don't know why. You know, those of us, you know, if you think about that's the equivalent of Christmas shopping and shutting down the cash registers for 3 days in early December or something. I mean, it's like that's not when you'd expect
late November.
It. Yeah.
yeah.
You wouldn't expect it to be
well,
shut down.
Well, most people
then.
Are anticipating that all of these changes are going to result in lower signups. Fewer people are going to purchase their insurance on
Can the state of Ohio invest any money in this stuff? I mean, couldn't they?
What, they from could. Where? What are they going to, where are they going to get that money, Ann?
I don't know.
There's always the rainy day fund.
Hmm.
Well, we don't touch that, do we?
No.
The Department of Insurance has done a little bit this year, you know, as compared to past years. There were a couple counties that had no insurers offering plans,
mm-hmm.
and the Department of Insurance went out and negotiated with some of the insurers to get those counties covered. There's a they have a page on their website that tells kind of walks people through the process, but ultimately you have to go to healthcare.gov to sign up. Create an account and sign up.
All right. The open enrollment period starts November, goes through mid-December. It's shortened. For more information, we'll try to find a link and post it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And if you need help, hopefully that might help. Now, House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, Republican, is now challenging, is that for sure, Keith Faber, former Senate President Keith Faber, for state auditor.
So
it's an open seat.
Cliff Rosenberger, he's from Clarksville, and he's the current speaker. And he has said that he is giving it serious consideration that he'll run for auditor in 2018. If he goes ahead and does that, that will pit him against Keith Faber, former Senate President. So these guys know each other well. They've worked together for a long time. And, you know, it's funny because the Capitol Square rumor mill was working overtime last week because they got wind. Somehow, you know, there was this rumbling that Rosenberger would run for auditor and that would pit him against Faber. And maybe that was really a signal that Faber was going to move over to the AG's race, and mm-hmm. Dave Yost would you know move out of the AG's race and run for Pat Tiberi's seat, and like there's going to be all these dominoes falling, and that's just not happening. Yost says he's running for AG. Faber says he's running for auditor. So we'll see what the speaker does.
I'm reading the Dispatch right now, and it looks like Jim Siegel has a story that he's just put up that says that Rosenberger is not going to run for auditor.
I'm okay. Cut off the press.
Breaking
yeah.
news
yeah,
there.
It's coming right now. Jim Siegel's story says, Rosenberger says in the statement that he has been humbled by the encouragement he received from colleagues and constituents to seek the office, but he has decided against it. And Rosenberger quoting here, I intend to devote my remaining 14 months as a Speaker of the House to work with our members to promote politics that serve the most pressing needs for the people of Ohio.
The question is, what'd they offer him to get out of the race? When they offer him to not jump in, is he going to run for anything else? Or
I'm not seeing that in the story.
He's also talked about running for county commission in his home
but,
area.
I mean, statewide auditor, county commissioner, that doesn't seem like
House
a good—
House speaker to county commissioner.
Yeah. I think there's maybe more news to come on this.
Yeah, I think there is,
Stand
too.
By,
That's a
yeah.
breaking story there.
Stay tuned, people. All right. What else? Gosh.
Now so, what are we going to talk about?
Well, Governor
Rosenberger out of the race.
What's his name? Governor Kasich was on Fox News Sunday talking about millennials and Gen Xers thinking that they think profoundly differently than Republican nationalists. And that truer words were never spoken, but that's not news. let's listen to the cut, though, anyway.
They care about the environment. They don't want to focus on all these social issues. They understand America's place in the world. They're comfortable with global outreach. It's immigration, another one. So what's going to happen over time is that the Gen Xers and the millennials are going to begin to overtake the baby boomers. And it will mean a profound shift in the way both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party function. And the question is, and to some sense, they're up for grabs because right now they're leaning independent. And the question is, who appeals to them?
Right now, I mean, if you count the Gen Xers and the millennials, they definitely eclipse baby boomers in numbers. If they only knew that and actually went to the polling places and voted, they could make an impact. But he makes an important point. I mean, and that group just gets bigger and bigger every year in terms of the number of voters. The Republican Party's got some issues to confront in coming years.
How are they going to expand their base is what the big tent what thing he's is talking like, about.
No one said big tent in a long time.
You know, it seems like everything that's been going on in this past election cycle has been to kind of, you know, narrow the tent.
But I'm not sure the Democrats do a much better job.
Well, I don't think so either.
Yeah. You know, I think that if you look back at the 2016 presidential race, you know, about a third of American voters voted for Trump and about a third voted for Hillary Clinton and about a third stayed home. Like, there were a lot of people who were just not inspired. They were not motivated. They just didn't like either candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think that the party that puts forth somebody who's charismatic and inspiring will have a bigger head start in the next race.
I think there's a certain amount of frustration, honestly, among millennials, especially because when you go out and talk to them around election time, they're talking about issues that candidates don't talk about. This whole thing about debt, college debt, it's huge among that set. And a lot of them feel like they're under crushing debt so that, you know, when they get the job they want and they're able to work, you know, in the capacity that they want to work for their lifetime, they're not going to make enough to ever own a home. They're not going to make enough to pay off that debt and do what their parents did. And I think there's a certain amount of frustration. At least that's what I hear when I talk to them. Mm-hmm. They don't seem to be focused on these, you know, right now, if you look at the Ohio legislature, the things that they're focused on, abortion, you know, gun rights and all these other things, that doesn't seem to be the kind of stuff that millennials are focused on. And the things that they're focused on are not, by and large, things that the legislature or even Congress is addressing. So I think that's where there's a disconnect there. And as far as Governor Kasich, you know, saying that, yes, you know, there may be some truth to that. But if he's, you know, thinking that he's like the millennial choice, I don't know that they would buy into, if they looked at his record, I don't know that they'd buy into a lot of things that he has supported, championed, and put
forward
in the past.
Or put the kibosh on, you know.
Right.
Well, he's definitely trying to forge a middle road here. He's definitely trying to promote bipartisanship and expanding the tent and all that kind of stuff, which is what, whether he's doing it on his own behalf because he wants to be a candidate himself, which is kind of what I think.
Yeah.
Or he's just trying to do it for the good of the party or, you know, whichever. But this is what this is what he's been doing for the last several months, this mantra. Yeah. I mean, it's.
The more I think about it, though, he keeps doing this. He keeps going down this road. There's no way he could get through a Republican primary. It just wouldn't happen right now. And it does make me wonder if he might go independent, go rogue.
You know, it's difficult because you have, you know, the parties, the rules are kind of set up so that you get on the ballot you have to get on the ballot in every single state and you have to meet certain criteria, and it's a much more difficult path.
Right. That he's been working on since the day after the election. Mm-hmm. So, or probably actually the day after he dropped out of the Republican primary.
Mm-hmm.
So, well over a year.
You know, I think, you know, I could see him after he's done being governor, I could see him going to some place like NBC or CBS and doing some sort of, you know, talking heads kind of show and trying to gain some traction there. I think that's, you know, that's something I could just vision him doing.
And something he did before, you know, he did before for Fox.
Right. Right. All right. So what are you guys looking forward to this week? I mean,
controlling board.
Oh, that's right.
I'm looking forward to controlling board today. You going to be there, Joe?
I think Andy's going to be there.
Is
so.
This Medicaid related?
It is Medicaid related. The controlling board is being asked today to release state funds. I think about $250 million. Mm-hmm. That would trigger the release of federal matching dollars, probably three or four times that amount. For Medicaid expansion population and services for that.
And?
This is kind of controversial because a lot of people, a lot of Republicans in the legislature are opposed to Medicaid expansion. Governor Kasich pushed it through with legislative help, but there's still a segment of the lawmakers who oppose it. So they put this little provision in the budget last time that requires the administration to come to the lawmakers, the controlling board, which is a legislative body, to get the release of money so they can jerk them around a little bit. Ultimately, I can't imagine they won't release the funds. I mean, if they don't release the funds, there's thousands of Ohioans that rely on these funds.
Their constituents, right.
Exactly, for addiction services, mental health services, all kinds of stuff.
And primary care. And we're talking like 715 or 725,000 people. So that's going to be a big showdown at 1:30 in the South Hearing Room.
Emphasis on show, I think.
Yeah. So they can say they tried to
right.
bring. Now, the controlling board is how the governor got through
right.
the last
right.
time. He
right.
fixed the board. He yeah.
Well, he makes... didn't fix the board. The legislative leaders put some new people on the controlling board to assure the votes, but presumably in coordination with the Kasich administration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the legislative leaders aren't doing that this time?
I think there have been a couple changes on the controlling board. I think Jay Hottinger isn't a member of the controlling board. I think he was put on last week. But it's not uncommon for people to be put on the controlling board for a meeting if someone else can't make the controlling board.
Okay.
But under circumstances like this, you would expect it to be more of a stacking situation. But I'm not sure if they've had to make any changes or not.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, we reported last week on the campaign finance reports that came through, and issue two is on track to become the most expensive ballot issue in Ohio history. The casino issue a couple of years ago spent a combined like $73 million, and issue two on the yes and the no side combined right at this point is $73 million. And that, of course, is the drug pricing law. So we'll see. Most of the money on the no side is coming in from the pharma, the trade association that includes like 37 drug makers, companies.
That looks like 58 million on that side, and what, another 14?
And then 16.5 million or so on the yes side.
So the no side, the pharmaceutical companies are outspending the proponents of this act by about four to one.
Yeah.
This is not surprising, and you know, you flip your TV on and you see the ads. They're unrelenting.
Yeah, and the direct mail's coming too, and that's unrelenting. And
people are so confused.
And still nobody knows what it's going to do.
People are always asking, you know, can you boil that down into 30 seconds? It's like, no, really? That's kind of hard to do.
You actually have to kind of study this and decide.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to him. But
he said, she said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's, you know, there is an election coming up a week from tomorrow. This is the the local elections, judicial stuff, and your millages and city council members, etc.
Election Day 2017. God, has it been a year already? Laura Bischoff, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Kathy Kandisky, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Kathy Kandisky, a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles, thanks to you as well.
It's been fun.
Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.